all of you for coming. Just to pick up on what was just said, when the book was first out, Lou Dobbs was kind enough to invite me on this show. And suffice it to say, he was unpersuaded of my arguments, but it was an interesting experience all the same. When you're a guest on the show, they put you in a green room, they call it, where you wait for your turn to go on the show, and I was the third or fourth person on that night. And so I watched the show up until it was my time to go on, and before each commercial break, Dobbs would tease the viewers about what was coming up next. And what he would say about me and my appearance is, coming up later on the show, we have a guest who thinks we should let even more illegal immigrants into the country. We'll be right back. And so you get out there, you're like, where do I start? But it's always nice to come to forums where people will hear me out. And so I want to thank you all again for coming. Obviously, I was invited to speak about this book that I wrote, the title of which is Let Them In, The Case for Open Borders. And the case for open borders is really pretty simple. It's not an argument for erasing the borders or ending U.S. sovereignty or one North American government or any other such nonsense. Rather, it's an argument for letting the free market, the law of supply and demand, determine the level of immigration in the U.S. Right now, that determination is made by politicians and public policymakers making arbitrary decisions. We'll let so many in from this country this year, so many in from that country next year. And like most exercises in Soviet-style central planning, it's been a complete disaster. We have thriving markets and document fraud and human smuggling in this country. We have dead bodies in the Arizona desert. And, of course, we have 12 million-plus illegal immigrants in the country. I think our politicians would do better to put in place mechanisms such as viable guest worker programs that are sensitive to the demands of the labor market and let market forces rather than politicians and bureaucrats determine the level of immigration. I think this would do two things. First, it would decrease illegal immigration, which is the goal that we all share. Give people more legal ways to enter the country, and they will use them. And second, and perhaps more importantly, in a post-9/11 world, is I think it will make us safer from a homeland security standpoint. Right now, our homeland security resources are being used to harass businesses and chase down economic migrants who come here to work. And I think this is a wasteful use of limited resources. I'd much rather have our Border Patrol focused on people who come here to cause trouble, gang members, gun runners. At this part in the speech, I normally say drug dealers, but I won't get into that with this crowd. But right now, they cannot focus all of their attention on real threats because they have to chase down people who come here to mow our lawns and burp our babies. And I think this is a silly policy that ultimately makes the country less safe. The Obama administration recently has said it plans to tackle immigration reform later this year. I wish them luck. We'll see if this president is more successful than his predecessor in this regard. Now, my experience has been that after I make the case for open borders, the goalposts sort of move. Once you explain how increasing legal ways for people to come would be an effective tool in decreasing illegal immigration, people essentially start telling you, well, we don't really need all the legal immigrants either. The Wall Street Journal's position on immigration is of a piece with the paper's general philosophy, which I happen to share. We favor free people and free markets, and that includes free and flexible labor markets. Most people who self-identify as free market conservatives claim to share this belief, and usually they do. But one glaring exception is when the topic turns to immigration. No self-respecting free market adherent would ever dream of supporting laws that interrupt the flow or the free movement of goods and services across international borders. But when it comes to laws that hamper the free movement of the workers who produce those goods and services, too many conservatives today abandon their free market principles. Adam Smith and David Ricardo and John Stuart Mill give way to people like Lou Dobbs. Ronald Reagan gives way to folks like Pat Buchanan. Principled conservatism gives way to a sort of reactionary populism. And some of us find this troubling. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is to show that there's not really any real inconsistency in advocating for both free markets and open immigration. The subtitle of the book is Six Common Arguments Against Immigration and Why They Are Wrong. And I chose that subtitle because over the years, I've heard the same anti-immigrant arguments repeatedly. They're stealing jobs. They're depressing wages. They're filling our jails and prisons. They're overburdening our welfare system, and so on. Yet time and again, my own reporting and research has found these claims to be either way overblown or simply counterfactual. One quick example. If your go-to person on immigration is Lou Dobbs or Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly or Laura Ingraham or Rush Limbaugh, you might be convinced that we are in the midst of an illegal immigrant crime wave in this country. Yet the evidence does not support this claim. Because many immigrants to the U.S., especially Mexicans and other Central Americans, are young men who arrive with very low levels of formal education, popular stereotypes tend to associate them with higher rates of crime and incarceration. But anecdotes can't substitute for empirical evidence. And the fact is that numerous studies by independent researchers and government commissions over the past 100 years have repeatedly found that immigrants are less likely to commit crimes or be behind bars than the native-born. In fact, among men between 18 and 39, who, of course, comprise the vast majority of the prison population, the incarceration rate of natives is 5 times higher than the incarceration rate of immigrants. And this is not because law-abiding model immigrants from India and China are compensating for crimes among uneducated, low-skilled Latino immigrants. For every ethnic group, without exception, incarceration rates are lowest for immigrants. And yes, this holds true for Mexicans and Salvadorans and Guatemalans who make up most of the illegal population in the U.S. Between 1994 and 2005, the illegal immigrant population of the U.S. is estimated to have doubled to around 12 million. Over that same period, according to the Department of Justice, the violent crime rate in America fell by a third. Crimes against property fell by 26%. And crime has fallen in cities with the largest immigrant populations, such as New York and LA and Chicago and Miami, as well as in border cities like El Paso and San Diego, which of course experience lots of illegal immigration. The bottom line is that the problem of crime in the U.S. is not caused or even aggravated by immigrants, regardless of their legal status. But the misperception that the opposite is true persists among our policymakers, the media, and the general public. Keep this in mind the next time you hear Bill O'Reilly use some undocumented drunk driver to claim that we are in the midst of an illegal alien crime wave. Now, I'd like to spend the balance of my time talking about assimilation, because I think this is an issue that, in some senses, even more than the economic concerns about immigration, resonates with a lot of Americans today. Whether you're conservative, liberal, Republican, or Democrat, you know, why do I have to press one for English? Why do my kids go to school with all these Spanish speakers? Why are so many signs in multiple languages? What's going on here? So I thought I'd talk about immigration a little bit tonight. Many social conservatives in particular question whether America is capable of assimilating this latest wave from Latin America and whether we are in fact doing so. And I'm going to use the Irish experience as a historical comparison to today's Latinos, because there's a lot of similarities, frankly, in that comparison. And I've come to believe that if America could assimilate the 19th century Irish immigrants, we can probably assimilate anybody. We've all heard the stories about no Irish need apply signs in store windows and the like, but I'd like to give you a slightly more vivid portrait of Irish immigration in the 1800s. A French traveler in the 1830s returned from a trip that included America and Ireland and wrote the following: "I have seen the Indian in his forest and the Negro in his chains, and thought, as I contemplated their pitiable condition, that I saw the very extreme of human wretchedness. But I did not then know the condition of unfortunate Ireland." This was not an exaggeration. Slaves in the U.S. had longer life expectancy than the Irish peasants who emigrated here. Slaves also ate better and lived in cabins built with sturdier materials and better ventilation. Like other early immigrant groups, the Irish came over in the hold of cargo ships, which were built with little regard for the needs of passengers. There were no toilet facilities, for example, so filth and odor and disease were common. In 1847, about 20% of Irish immigrants fleeing the potato famine died en route to the U.S., or just after they arrived here. By comparison, the loss of life of slaves traveling on British vessels in the 19th century averaged about 9%. Why was the Irish death rate more than double that of slaves? Simple, it was economics. Those slaves were property. Someone had a stake in keeping them alive. Nobody cared if the Irish immigrants died. It's also worth noting that the Irish were coming from a country where more than 80% of the population was rural, yet they were settling in cities like New York and Boston and Philadelphia. And they met resistance from those who said, America has no use for this unskilled labor. The argument was that we were in the middle of an industrial revolution at the time. The future was factories, not farms, and the Irish would never assimilate to an urban capitalist society. Of course, these naysayers were wrong. The U.S. did have a need for this unskilled labor. Supply created its own demand, something that conservatives like to talk about when the topic is not immigrants. And this increase in workers did not go to waste. Supply created its own demand. The Irish did jobs that were considered too lowly or dangerous for natives, even for slaves, who again were considered too valuable. They built roads and canals and railroads. They worked in mines. When Frederick Law Olmsted, the famous designer of New York City's Central Park, once inquired about the division of labor between slaves and Irish workers on a riverboat in Alabama, he was told, quote, "The niggers are worth too much to be risked here. If the paddies are knocked overboard or get their backs broke, nobody loses anything." The phrase "jobs Americans won't do" has taken on a negative connotation today, as if it's an insult to Americans or their Protestant work ethic. This is nonsense. Throughout history, immigrants the world over have performed jobs that the natives spurned, whether it was Indians in South Africa or Italians in Argentina or Turks in Germany. Not only did the Irish do jobs that were considered beneath Americans, they did jobs that were considered beneath American slaves. Irish women typically worked as domestic servants. What do I mean by typically? In 1855, 99% of all domestic servants in New York City were Irish women. As late as 1920, 80% of all Irish women working in America were domestic servants. That's a snapshot of where the Irish started. Now let me give you a snapshot of where they ended up. The Irish did assimilate, of course, and then some. They produced writers and painters and presidents. They produced doctors and lawyers and school teachers. They produced civic leaders and businessmen, including Henry Ford, whose father fled the Irish potato famine and who would go on to revolutionize transportation in America. According to the latest census figures, as of 2006, 31% of Irish Americans had at least a bachelor's degree. 31% versus 21% of the nation as a whole. And the median annual income for Irish Americans was $54,000 versus $48,000 for all households. Apparently, the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of all those hard-working Irish immigrants who would never amount to anything turned out okay. And although the Irish experience has been replicated by other large immigrant groups from Europe and Asia, this history is often ignored or played down when we discuss Latino immigrants today. The opposite should be the case. The next time you hear someone say that Mexicans lack the skills to make it in our advanced economy, that they start off way too far down the socioeconomic ladder to ever make it here, that they will forever be stuck doing menial jobs that we don't need done anyway, remember the Irish. It's sometimes argued that Latinos hang on to their native Spanish and that this is proof that they aren't assimilating. We're told that past immigrant groups quickly adopted English and that the prevalence of Spanish-speaking Latinos today is a situation that America has never faced before. We're told that Hispanics cordon themselves off in barrios with their own stores and restaurants in an attempt to preserve their culture instead of adopting ours. Well, this argument is nothing new, and it's no more valid today than when Benjamin Franklin made it 250 years ago. Franklin complained that German immigrants, whom he called the most stupid of their nation, were too plentiful. In 1751, he wrote, "Why should Pennsylvania, founded by the English, become a colony of aliens who will shortly be so numerous as to Germanize us instead of us Anglifying them, and who will never adopt our language and customs?" Franklin was one of the most enlightened men of his day. Yet on immigration, he sounds like Lou Dobbs or Pat Buchanan or some conspiracy theorist. And the reason is that he was living in the middle of a wave of German immigration, and he lacked perspective. In 18th century America, it was possible to travel from Pennsylvania to Georgia and speak only German. The Germans had preserved their language and culture in socially enclosed enclaves strung along hundreds of miles to the Cumberland Valley, the Shenandoah Valley, and the Carolinas. Historians report that even into the 19th century, German immigrants lived largely to themselves in German-speaking communities with numerous German-language newspapers and periodicals and with their own special foods, drinks, and social organizations. During the Civil War, there were all German units in the Union Army, with their commands being given in German. Again, the point I'm making is that today's immigrants from Latin America aren't really any different in terms of behavior patterns. They're just newer. America has been through all of this before. With each new wave, there's a fear that the country is being overwhelmed, that the latest immigrant group will change America more than America changes the immigrants. Of course, the Germans clearly influenced our culture. They gave us kindergarten and marching bands and Christmas trees. And I'm sure... and I'm sure some people here today have German ancestry. But I doubt many of you speak fluent German. Let me give one last example of an argument used today to paint Latino immigrants as somehow sui generis. It's said that Latino immigrants are unique because of their proximity to their homeland, that many come just to make money and then go back home, that many aren't interested in laying down roots and becoming Americans. By contrast, we're told thousands of miles of ocean separated prior immigrant groups from their homeland. So when they came to stay and were committed to becoming Americans. Well, that's not what the record shows. Italian immigrants started coming in substantial numbers in the late 1880s. Like the Irish, the vast majority were desperately poor, illiterate, and had no skills of seeming value to America's industrial economy. Italians were said to have an aversion to formal education. Italy had one of the highest illiteracy rates in Europe, and it was particularly high in southern Italy, which is where most Italian Americans trace their ancestry. In New York, Italian labor helped build the subway system, but they were also employed as what were called rag pickers in the city dumps. Their job was to go through the city's garbage and find salvageable items. In 1910, Italian men earned less annually than either white or black men. Italian immigrants to the U.S. and elsewhere also had a habit of returning home after a period. This was planned from the outset. Travel abroad, make some money, and go back home. If you run out of money, travel abroad again. In the immigration literature, these temporary migrants are known as sojourners. And Italian sojourners pop up all over the world. Between 1876 and 1976, around 26 million people left Italy and headed to Western Europe and the Americas. Around 8.5 million of them, or around a third, eventually returned home. Altogether, about 5 million Italians immigrated to the U.S. between 1876 and 1930. Of these, 2 million returned to Italy. An estimated 63% of Italians who came between 1902 and 1923 returned to Italy. And Italians weren't the only sojourners. 46% of Hungarians went back. So did 36% of Slovenians, 48% of the French, 46% of the Greeks. There's a whole book about this written by a man named Mark Wyman. It's called Round Trip to America, The Immigrants' Return to Europe. Something like one-third of European newcomers returned home in the period leading up to World War I. Why is none of this ever discussed when people complain about Latino immigrants who want to work here for a period and then go back home? You'd think no one had ever done this before. And by the way, there may not be an ocean between the U.S. and Latin America, but many Latino immigrants are in fact traveling thousands of miles to reach their U.S. destinations. We know their migration patterns thanks to the remittances they send back home when they're here. And they don't come from just across the border, which is a relatively unpopulated region. The Latino immigrants you find in Omaha, Chicago, and Seattle, for example, typically hail from the rural state of Michoacan, which is just east of Mexico City, the capital. Michoacan is more than 1,500 miles from Chicago and some 2,000 miles from Seattle. Mexican immigrants in Boston tend to come from the Mexican state of Jalisco, a little further north, and those in New York tend to come from Puebla, a state that is south of the capital and more than 2,000 miles away. Let's just say that these immigrants aren't popping back home for weekend visits. My purpose in bringing up these historical comparisons is not to argue over who had the worst experience. The point is to show that the arguments against Mexican immigration today are old hat. Mexicans aren't facing anything new, and the history tells us that the obstacles they do face are not insurmountable. Let me wrap up by talking about the traditional indicators of American assimilation. These include English language use, poverty rates, education, home ownership. And the worry is that Hispanic immigrants are lagging in these measures. Now, to the extent that that's true, it fits the historical pattern with other low-skill immigrants from Europe and Asia. The issue is whether the Latino lag in acculturation and socioeconomic progress just seems worse than it is due to the volume of Mexican immigration in recent decades. Immigration from all of Latin America totaled 3 million between 1981 and 1990. Immigration from Mexico alone totaled more than 4 million in the 1990s. Those kinds of numbers can and do produce the illusion of non-advancement. And that's why it's important to remember when people start throwing around averages that Latino immigration is ongoing. The public is fed a lot of snapshot data on English language skills and high school dropout rates, for example, but they are of little use in measuring assimilation. Assimilation is a function of time spent in the country. What we really want to know is how immigrants are faring over time. We want to know whether someone who's been here 5 years speaks English better than someone who's been here 25 years. When you're averaging in thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who got here last year with someone whose English language skills are being measured, and they've, I'm sorry, when you're measuring or comparing the English language skills of thousands of people who just arrived yesterday with people who have been here 20 years, it skews the outcome. And that's not a measure of assimilation. What you really need to do is use longitudinal studies, which follow the same individuals over a period of time and measure that advancement. And when you do use longitudinal studies to measure assimilation, you find out that socioeconomic progress is in fact being made. Progress is slower in some areas, such as education level of adult immigrants, and faster in others, such as income and home ownership rates. But there's no doubt that both assimilation and upward mobility are taking place over time. And that's certainly the case with respect to linguistic assimilation, which is one of the more important measures because it amounts to a job skill that can increase earnings. The historical pattern with other groups is that the first generation learns enough English to get by but prefers the mother tongue. The children of immigrants born in the U.S. grow up in homes where they learn, to some extent, the mother tongue. They understand it, they may speak it, but they prefer English. And when they grow up, they establish homes where English is the dominant language. According to 2005 census data, just one-third of immigrants who are in the country for less than a decade speak English well, but that number climbs to around 75% for those here 30 years or more. There may be more bilingualism today among children of immigrants, but there's no indication that Spanish is the dominant language in the second generation. Studies show that 91% of the children and 97% of the grandchildren of Mexican immigrants speak English well. I want to close with a few words about the uniqueness and success of the American assimilation model. I opened the book with a quote from Ronald Reagan. It's from a speech he gave in China in 1984, where he said the following: America is really many Americas. We call ourselves a nation of immigrants, and that's what we truly are. We have drawn people from every corner of the earth. We're composed of virtually every race and religion, and not in small numbers, but large. We have a statue in New York Harbor that speaks of this, a statue of a woman holding a torch of welcome to those who enter our country to become Americans. She has greeted millions upon millions of immigrants to our country. She welcomes them still. She represents our open door. All of the immigrants who came to us brought their own music, literature, customs, and ideas. And the marvelous thing, a thing of which we're proud, is that they did not have to relinquish these things in order to fit in. In fact, what they brought to America became American. And this diversity has more than enriched us. It has literally shaped us. I think Reagan articulated the uniqueness of the U.S. assimilation model. In America, assimilation is less about immigrants adopting our culture than about immigrants adopting our values. And America has been uniquely successful in this regard, particularly in contrast to Europe. The key to the success of the U.S. assimilation model is that we put more stress on shared values rather than shared cultures. Immigrants find our values and ideals as attractive as our economic opportunities. Yes, they come here to get rich, but it's more than that. It's also our value framework, with its emphasis on individual initiative and individual opportunity. Foreigners like the fact that you can make more money here because you are hardworking or diligent or clever. Immigrants are also attracted to our civic institutions. We're the land of liberty and democracy. Here you can say what you want, be what you want, do what you want. These are attractive values. And again, we're much more concerned about shared values than shared cultural artifacts in this country. If American culture is under assault today, It's not from too many immigrants who aren't assimilating, but from our modern elites who reject the concept of assimilation. For multiculturalists, particularly those in the academy, assimilation is a dirty word that elicits not just indifference, but outright hostility. Some don't want to judge one culture as superior or inferior to another. They espouse a kind of value-neutral belief system. If some societies believe in genital mutilation or keeping women uneducated and covered in a burqa, who are we to judge? Other multicultural advocates reject the assimilation paradigm outright on the grounds that the U.S. hasn't always lived up to its stated ideal. Americans slaughtered Indians and enslaved blacks, goes this argument. And that wicked history means we have no right to impose a value system on others. But social conservatives who want to seal the border in response to these liberal elites are directing their wrath at the wrong people. The problem isn't the immigrants, it's the multiculturalists who want to turn America into a loose federation of ethnic groups. Conservatives are right to complain about bilingual education advocacy, anti-American Chicano studies professors, Spanish language ballots, ethnically gerrymandered voting districts, La Raza's big government agenda, and so forth. But these problems weren't created by the women changing linen at your hotel or the men building homes in your neighborhood. I say keep the immigrants, deport the Columbia faculty. Despite what you hear on talk radio and cable news, the American public hasn't lost confidence in the melting pot. If it had, you'd know it. There would be English-only signs everywhere, militarized border zones. There would be ubiquitous police checkpoints and far-right political parties like France's National Front. Of course, there is some bigotry and stupidity out there, which we'll always have. But when people really can't live another day with other kinds of people, they don't send emails to the O'Reilly Factor. They engage in ethnic cleansing. You get the Serbs and the Croats and the Balkans, the Hindus and Muslims in India, the Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda. What we have in America is a periodic grumpiness about the most recent arrivals, a vague and ambivalent disdain that doesn't settle too deeply in the psyche. Americans still believe that our assimilationist model is working, even if our politicians and media elites sometimes try to make them think otherwise. Thank you.